Nick, thanks for joining us again on the Big Picture Podcast. I know you're a repeat guest. For those who have not been opportune to listen to you, could you just introduce yourself again and tell us what you want us to know about you?
Yeah, man, absolutely. I couldn't get enough of you, so I came back on. Nick Hughes, CEO of EIDR Technologies. We are a services firm that concentrates on automation, usually of cloud, cybersecurity, and DevSecOps platforms. And we also do some rapid prototyping and software development as well.
Nice. And for today, we're just basically going to be talking about a little bit of what you do, as well as focusing mostly on artificial intelligence, machine learning, the impacts of those two in cybersecurity, threat intel, what people should pay attention to now that AI is all over the place. AI can make me sound like whoever. AI can make anybody sound like me, and on and on and on. So to kind of start with, what do you think about this recent trend of AI everything? Faces and videos and fake this and fake that. What's your take on this AI we're seeing now?
It's a really interesting time, isn't it? You know, we have a lot of new innovation that's available to us. And, you know, a lot of this stuff that's coming out is, you know, productivity enhancing, which I'm all for, right? Like, you know, one of the my core principles has always been efficiency. Everything that I do, I want to be efficient with, right? So like if I can have some tool set that's allowing me to be more efficient in my duties, that's awesome. But there's this flip side, right? And you already mentioned a few of the things, and that's, you know, there's the ability to create a bunch of false contact when it comes to like text and video and audio, and you know, it feeds into like the deep fakes and misinformation and all of these bad things as well. So, you know, with anything throughout history, I feel like any innovation has always come with some downsides, right? That's not a new thing. But with the pace and impact of innovation in today's age, right? Like, you know, in our information age that we're in now, the impact is greater than anything that we've seen before. And so I don't know, like it's real easy to get caught up in both the positive and the negative, yep. Right? You know, you have a lot of people out there that are huge proponents, and then you have a lot of people that are huge detractors. But you know, with anything, I usually fall in the middle, right? You know, I'm pretty moderate when it comes to most things, and so you know, I try to take advantage of the pluses while keeping mindful of the negatives.
Right, right. As you were describing it, you touched on something I want to focus in on: efficiency. November 2022, when ChatGPT was introduced, and everybody was wondering, what is this witchcraft? Which is what I still call it. It's literally witchcraft. You can just tell it to say something, and then it gives you pages and pages of information, and you're double checking. In most cases, it's giving you correct information, except when it's giving you false information, which doesn't happen often. However, as far as efficiency goes, just thinking generally, not even bringing it home to cybersecurity, if I'm a school teacher and I'm telling ChatGPT to give me a class notes for my classroom, give me a lesson plan. A lesson plan for fifth graders in geometry. And it gives me something decent, and that makes me efficient. Instead of spending 2 hours at midnight preparing lesson plan for the next day, now I can do that very efficiently. So in terms of efficiency, how would you say ChatGPT is going to disrupt certain fields to start with a field you're very familiar with, cybersecurity, information security, what do you think is going to be efficiency-wise the good and the bad of AI?
Yeah, so I guess to go back to your example, in the case of a lesson plan, the efficiency is gained by coming up with ideas, putting them inside of a framework, and doing that very quickly. But like you said, there's also times where those LLMs hallucinate.
Right.
You know, they come up with weird stuff that's not factually correct. So in the case of a teacher, you can't take that stuff at face value. You have to double check it. But still, if you were to come up with, you know, the prompt where it comes up with the context for what you're asking, maybe some hints at the kind of thing that you're looking for, coming up with that perfect prompt, looking at the results, putting it in a separate document and starting to edit it down, add things where necessary, do fact checking on some things. That's going to take you much less time than if you were to do the entire thing from scratch, right? So I think we're still in an area where it is an aid to humans who have expertise in the area that they're querying, right? So, in the context of cybersecurity, I've heard that a lot of people have been able to use ChatGPT and other LLMs in order to get cybersecurity policy and ask questions and things like that and almost use it as a sounding board. And that's great, but you have to have some knowledge to be able to check on the things that that it's suggesting, right? You can't just take it at face value, because when it boils down to it, this is a piece of technology that comes up with the next best word in a sentence, right? It's constantly going through and saying, what should I say next to get to the end goal? Because of bad data ingested or these weird hallucination episodes or some other misunderstandings of the prompt or something like that, you can end up with varied results. You can't just take it at face value. To talk to the other side of your question, what areas I think will be mainly impacted. I saw a graph come out recently. I can't remember where I saw it, but it was in some article. But it was basically the change in number of Upwork jobs since ChatGPT was released. So, they had categories of different types of jobs and whether or not there was a negative percentage change in that category or a positive percentage change. And the long and short of it was that across all the categories that they showed in the graphic, at least, it was somewhat of a wash. There was some categories which were greatly impacted, right? Like nobody's going out to Upwork to look for people for this anymore because they're having ChatGPT do it. But there are other categories which have seen a boom where more people are getting involved, right? So like, I think the biggest players on either side was that like general writing was the biggest hit in the negative, right? So I think it was something like a 30% hit on number of Upwork jobs that were listed out there for people to take since ChatGPT was released. But on the other side, video editing and production was seeing an almost 40% boom. So I think that's my general, I don't know, attitude toward innovation in general, and more specifically AI and LLMs that we're sort of into now that most people are talking about, is that any of these things are going to both impact jobs negatively, but also create opportunity in other areas. And so it's just a matter of us keeping our eye on the innovation and the technology and what impacts it might have, and being able to be fluid and maybe repurpose some skills that we have in order to move with the times.
And something that came to mind as you were describing that was when the internet itself came online, I think about 30, 35 years ago, and a lot of people were saying, oh, wow, newspapers are going to go out of business and some jobs are going to be lost. However, the internet brought way more jobs, way more innovations and chances to go in so many different directions than jobs that were lost. So it's, I guess, boils down to the kind of adaptability we can all collectively leverage to be able to say that AI is not going to replace me at work. It's someone who knows how to use AI. That's the person that is going to replace me at my job. So that's a very good mindset to have. So to kind of pivot into threat intelligence, first of all, from your perspective, because threat intel is one of those things that everybody can define it in different ways. It's kind of like saying, what is a video game? You can go in so many directions with that. So from Nick's point of view, can you tell us what you think about threat intelligence?
Yeah, so threat intelligence to me is really any sort of information that can be used to determine what's going to try to negatively impact my IT infrastructure as a company or person or something like that, right? So there are tons of different sources of information and different ways to get them. It's really a matter of like, how do we take all of this information that's available about bad actors, you know, the source IPs that they're coming from, the DNS domains that they're using for command and control, you know, file hashes for the malware, code signing keys that have been leaked and now are being used nefariously. You know, how do we use all of those information sources within our cybersecurity environment in order to protect ourselves from all of those bad things? And so, you know, to boil it down to one word, threat intelligence is just information.
And I agree with that definition as well, because to even break it down further, intelligence is basically something that wasn't known before, that has not been brought to our attention. Something I didn't know before, maybe regarding a particular route I take to work, I have information that there's going to be traffic on that route, so I take a different route. That's literally intelligence about traffic intelligence, whatever we want to call it. Bringing it down to security, home security. Maybe there's a series of burglaries in my neighborhood, and I have that information, and then I take adequate steps to protect my home for that period of time, and so on and so forth. Bringing into the organization, just a mid-sized marketing agency that recently learned that cyber threat actors are putting the credentials of employees at other marketing agencies on the dark web. Therefore, that marketing agency will take steps to protect their credentials of their employees from ending up on the dark web. Everybody reset your passwords. Everybody don't use the same passwords on your Gmail for your work email, and on and on and on. So basically, intelligence, anything that can be used to protect us from risk, basically. So in the context of artificial intelligence, AI for threat intelligence. So now we're using intelligence in two different ways. Artificial intelligence for traditional, regular intelligence. How would you say AI has changed the threat landscape as of February 2024?
Wow. Yeah, so AI has changed the threat landscape in a number of different ways. You know, like I said at the beginning, there are pros and cons to everything. This is another sort of dichotomy that we see with tool usage, insofar as you can use artificial intelligence, LLMs, machine learning, analytics, and things like that on the blue side, right? The protector side of cybersecurity. But what do you think the bad guys are doing too? So, you know, anytime there's new technology that comes out, you're going to see both sides of the war, in, you know, quotes, that are going to start using that. And it's really a matter of how quickly can you start using it and how pervasively can you incorporate its benefits into your workflows. So, you know, I think that was kind of like a vague answer to your question, right? But like, at its core, that's really what we're talking about is, you know, sure, it's impacted the threat landscape quite a bit on both sides of the house. And it's really just, it's making the game faster, I think, right? You know, like things that used to take a little bit of time to do are being automated more and more. And, you know, the things that humans had to be in the loop for are sometimes lessened with the addition of LLMs that can, you know, take inputs programmatically and then produce outputs that could also be used as part of an automation, right? So think of a scenario where you have a bad actor who's using some automated means of determining the best way to access an organization, right? Like they've identified a target and they want to try and find ways in. You know, a lot of the early stage stuff has always been automated, right? Like port scanning and things like that. You know, finding different domains owned by the company, IP address blocks and things like that, and doing research on those things. Pouring over the research now could be something that's done by AI, right? Like, hey, take all this information and tell me what you think. And like, maybe the AI identifies an open port and, you know, at that port number, an old software version that's vulnerable to something. And it can not only say like, hey, here's the way in, right? Like here's the golden nugget in this big, you know, mound of dirt that you handed me. Since it can output that information programmatically, you could also take that and input it into another automation framework and start taking advantage of that, right? Like it can automate the whole thing. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of different ways that these new technologies can be used on both sides of the house. So it's really a matter of understanding the impact and trying to use it in the best way possible to protect your organism.
You mentioned something about how quickly you can set up your AI tools and systems and whatever get up you're trying to put together so that you can be faster, at least one click faster than the bad guys. So which brings me to the concept of speed. Recently, since ChatGPT has been around, we've seen how these bad guys are now using ChatGPT to compose phishing emails. And it sounds like you can tell it to write an email as if it's a CFO, a chief financial officer, writing the email. And then you send it to one of your employees in the CFO's organization. And before you know it, that employee is wiring millions of dollars to an account offshore controlled by the bad guys. Or you tell it to write a phishing email like the chief medical officer of a big major hospital in your city, and it's sending it to a doctor's office somewhere within that city saying, you need to fill this form to be in compliance, blah, blah, blah. And then the doctor is filling this information and including personal information of his or her patients because they think the medical director from somewhere is sending them the email. So, and then you mentioned automation, the ability to basically modularize be at Killchain. I'm doing recon. I'm automating my port scans. And then I'm using automation to deliver the malware. And then I'm using automation to basically set up the command and control server so that all my beacons in your network is talking to my C2 server, and I'm literally sleeping and I'm hacking you guys while I'm sleeping because everything is automated. So on the other side of that, how can we as defenders automate the defending process? Because if it's automatable from the bad guys, then the good guys should also be able to automate something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main barrier to that is culture and dollars, right? Like the amount of budget that's allocated. So there's a lot of organizations out there that are quite frankly underfunded from a cybersecurity perspective. And it's really easy to get into that type of mindset as an organization, because cybersecurity isn't what is generating hard dollars within your company, right? Like having a good cybersecurity posture, having good cyber hygiene, these things aren't the things that are making money for your company. And sure, when there's an incident, it costs you money to not have the best possible coverage within your environment. But until that time, it's all about making the case for it. You know, how well can the person in charge of security, right? Like your director of security, your CISO or CISO, however you like to pronounce it, how well can they articulate to the people with the purse strings how bad this could be if something were to go south, and how it's in everybody's best interest to put money into the protection of the enterprise. Because the bad actors, they don't have that fight, right? Like their job and their way of making money is to get past your security controls, right? That's how they make money, from ransomware, from Bitcoin mining operations, things like that. You know, their criminal enterprise is set up to make money off of your mistakes. And so you need to be aware of what the risks are. You need to know what level you need to be at, right? Like everybody has different risk profiles. If you're a small business with a very small footprint, and maybe you don't have a lot of external endpoints or things like that, maybe your risk profile is more based upon your users, right? Like, so you dedicate resources to protecting from like phishing campaigns and other bad things, right? Like another company that provides web services, APIs, something like that, they have a different risk profile. When you put some service out on the internet for the world to see, it's going to be found pretty quickly. And, then people are going to be finding ways to try and get in. And so maybe you need a lot more dollars spent in, API security and protecting those things, firewalls, whatever, things you want to throw in front of your external endpoints. So, risk profiles are all different, right? But like somebody needs to evaluate those and come up with an idea of what budget is needed, and then be able to articulate that properly to executives that are in charge of funding your budget. And, hopefully you get everything that you asked for, and you have enough people and you have enough money to buy tooling or whatever. But like everything's going to come down to a build versus buy type of decision, right? You know, I feel like I'm always on repeat saying this, but like it's ultimately true where, you know, the first decision that you have when you're trying to figure out like, okay, we've decided that we need some sort of automated mechanism to protect our infrastructure. Okay, is something available that we can purchase, or is this something that we need to build? Do we have the in-house expertise and also the free time and whatever other activities that we have to do to be able to do this? Because there's a lot of smart people out there, right? And so, you know, sure, an organization could totally do this themselves. But the question is, should they? You know, if somebody's already solved the problem for you and, you know, the amount of dollars you would throw at labor in order to develop this in-house is more than what you would pay for some commercial off the shelf type of solution. You know, you have to weigh that. And then, you know, if you decide like, hey, we don't have the time, we don't have the expertise, whatever, and you're going to be in the buy realm, you're usually in one of two categories inside of that, where you're either buying something that a company has productized and is selling to the mass market, or you're working with an organization that, you know, has a platform that they work with that they can tweak in order to fulfill your needs, right? So like, that's kind of where we live a lot of times at EITR. Is, you know, we're a services organization. We don't make products, right? Like we don't have something that we just say, okay, you know, go to our website and put in a credit card and you're signed up for it, right? Like that's not what we do. But what we do have is we have platforms that we roll out. One of them's our threat intelligence platform, SentryStream. And, you know, it doesn't do anything by itself. It's a platform for you to take threat intel feeds and maybe do some processing to them and send them onward to follow-on systems. So if you have like some sort of security analytics in your big data lake and you have, you know, a couple of dozen different threat intel databases that you want to pull down and normalize and, you know, deduplicate whatever, and then send them on, like that's the type of thing that can do that. So, you know, there's a lot of decisions to be made on how you execute that budget and get to the end goal.
Right. So are there some success stories you can share as sanitized as possible about how automated threat intel was used to either prevent an attack or during the stages of an attack to mitigate and contain the attack? Any success stories?
Well, the best success stories are the prevention stories, right? You know, threat intelligence can be used in two ways. One way is proactively. Can you feed it into firewalls or, you know, DNS black holes or whatever in order to prevent compromise? And then the other thing is, you know, feeding threat intelligence into more reactive type of channels. Like maybe you're feeding threat intelligence into your SIEM or SIM, and you know it's allowing you to figure out when maybe something bad is happening, right? Like all of a sudden you see in log outputs or, you know, NetFlow or something like that one of your systems is calling out to a known bad endpoint. You know, that's a little bit too late in my eyes.
Right, right.
So, you know, getting information as quickly as possible into preventative measures is always ideal. And so, you know, we've had some customers that we've worked with in the past where we have ingested threat intelligence into those types of preventative measures. You know, like external firewall rules and things like that automatically. And, you know, they're up to the minute blocking the latest and greatest known bad actors from entering their locations. And so, you know, we've definitely had a lot of instances where we've implemented those types of technologies and had customers come back and say like, okay, yeah, you know, we're seeing all of this, this block data in our logs now. And, you know, we know that we're safe from at least those things and we can concentrate in other areas and things like that. So, you know, it's again, one of those things where you have to look at your risk profile though, and determine which areas you want to concentrate on first, right? Like where are dollars spent the most important? Because like I said before, there's so many different types of threat intelligence databases, right, and so many different ways to use them. And so, you know, you need to find out what's the best for your organization and implement that.
Right. So it sounds like proactive is better than reactive. And another element of organizational networks that a lot of people don't pay attention to is IoT, Internet of Things. Many organizations spend tons of money on their physical security, which means cameras and security cameras, the door lock systems, you use your key card to badge in, and there is all sorts of devices connected to their network. Some of them pay attention to those devices, and recently the news came out that some toothbrushes, electric toothbrushes, were used to hack into a network. I mean, I can understand how that can happen because I'm in cybersecurity. Most people I know were scratching their heads thinking, how did that happen, and so on and so forth. So bringing it back to the organization and the network and firewalls and so on, what can you say about IoT? Where does IoT sit in this new age of AI and threat intel and security?
Oh, man, IoT is a hard one, right? So you have two really, really rough categories at the high end, right? You know, number one, you have your general purpose commercial, you know, things that you use at home type of IoT devices. Then you have things that are more tailored to like business or industrial use. So from a home perspective, right, like the case of the internet connected toothbrushes, I really get frustrated. I don't know if I'm old, you know, like I have too much gray in my beard and I'm just like, oh, these newfangled things. But it's like, why? Why do I need an internet connected toothbrush, right? Like, to totally understand electric toothbrushes, you know, they have a lot of like cool things built into them in order to like really get your teeth clean and things like that. Like, awesome. But is there a reason that needs to be connected to some sort of internet endpoint, right? Like, why are is it basically like, now we know when Nick is brushing his teeth, and we know the frequency at which he's brushing his teeth, and we're going to lump that into every other data point that we have about Nick. And so now we know that like, he probably wakes up at like 5:30 in the morning and brushes his teeth like shortly thereafter. And, you know, doesn't brush them in the middle of the day, but he brushes them at the end of the day. You know, he goes to bed about this time. So let's make sure that we send those spam emails like right at this time, because he's got to be reading them. Like, I don't know the point of it, right? Like, other than just like trying to scrape every single piece of data about me, you know, like, do I really need this thing? My dishwasher is internet connected. I don't know why, but it is. And, you know, I have like a Samsung dishwasher and a Samsung TV, and I'll be watching my TV and my dishwasher will stop and it'll put a little notification up there that says your dishwasher's stopped. You know, like, oh, it's finished. Who cares? I'm not going to get up from my show and go empty the dishwasher. I'll finish what I'm doing, and then like a normal human being, I'll walk into the kitchen and I'll see that the dishwasher is done, and then I can empty it. You know, like, I don't understand it. It's the most ludicrous thing that I've ever thought of in my entire life. Like, there's no reason for the internet connected pervasive things. So that was my rant. And the other side of it is that it's like almost bit impossible for the average person to protect against their toothbrush performing denial of service attacks, right? Like, it's just, it's too easy for people to take them over. And the only way that you're going to prevent that stuff is getting more involved in your home network setup than the average person does. Right. Right. So like, there's definitely a lot of folks out there that are all like excited about getting the newest and greatest, you know, wireless router for their house or something like that. Like, oh, you know, I don't use that thing that Comcast gave me, you know, I'm going to go ahead and buy this, what is it, like Ubiquiti or, you know, whatever other thing there is out there. Right. And I'm going to, you know, set this up and it's got all sorts of deny rules and it's got DNS black hole that I'm running on a Raspberry Pi. You know, like there's just totally those people out there, but they're a very small minority. Right. And so your average Joe, right? Like, you know, my mom's got wireless and she's not going to do all that stuff. So like, yeah. What about her toothbrush? so it's just, it's impossible to guard against. on the other side of it, right? You know, your business industrial uses, you're in a much better position to protect against those things as long as you're doing your due diligence, locking things down and looking for anomalous behavior. And also, number one, being aware of things on your network. So, you know, in the interest of aiding connectivity and, you know, allowing folks to get stuff done, you know, like there's campuses that have enabled wireless and people can take their laptops from conference room to conference room. And like, they know how to get on there. And, you know, sometimes it's a password that they have to enter in. So they can put their like phone on it and stuff like that. Well, they could also bring in any number of IoT devices from right. home and hook them up as well. So, you know, bring your own device type policies, you know, you could mandate all day long the different types of things that are supported and allowed on your network. But if you can't detect those things, you know, you're going to be in a world of hurt. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of ways that businesses can try and stay on top of IoT inside of their organizations, both, you know, things that are meant to be there, you know, for various reasons and things that, you know, pop up. But, you know, I think the first step is awareness, right? Like you have to have mechanisms in place in order to know what your network assets are at any given time and figure out when new things are popping up that are anomalous.
Right, right. And an example came to mind, one of the cases I worked on personally. This was back in 2021. So it started off as someone met someone online. They started dating. And this guy was actually, I want to say, a plant, an Intel spy, targeting his friend's organization. So he's dating this woman. This woman works in an organization out in California. So this guy bought a watch. I'm not going to say the kind of the product of... Yeah, I'm not going to say the product's name, but he bought a smartwatch for his girlfriend, and then he set it up for her, not knowing that this smartwatch is going to be the intro into this woman's organization. So, and then, of course, she wore the watch to work, and then he basically used that watch as a jump-off point into the network of that organization, and it was basically like corporate espionage. So IoT devices, he set it up for her. She trusted him, basically said, oh, my boyfriend bought me a smartwatch, then of course I'm going to, you know, take it. He presented it to her all fancy, but then he set it up for her already. So that is something to pay attention to. Companies, I mean, some companies have guest Wi-Fi, but then they don't pay attention to what happens on the guest Wi-Fi because they feel like if, you know, set it up appropriately, you need your phone number to log on so they know who you are. Yes, I can go to a gas station and buy a phone and then text me the digits to get on the Wi-Fi. I fulfilled your obligation. You don't know who's connected to your guest Wi-Fi. Is it a phone number that is registered to a driver's license or just a random phone number? That's just one story that came to mind, and I'm thinking, maybe this happens every day. Who knows?
Yeah, you know, it's like one of those things where you start with one particular attack vector or use case, and you just keep pulling the thread, and you start down this rabbit hole of oh my God, how do we protect that? Oh my God, how do we protect that? Right? So like that with having you know, wireless for employee mobility, like, okay, we'll have this separate thing that guests can get onto, or, you know, BYOD devices can get onto, and it'll be fine. Okay. And then, you know, then you say like, well, you know, we need this, you know, phone number to get on, and you gotta get a text, so that you can get the password to get on or whatever. Like, okay, you know, you filled that. And then we've got, you know, entry barriers, right? Like people can't just like walk into your front doors and things like that. Like, okay, well now do you have exterior cameras? Are you watching those diligently? Because I could just go like sit outside of a window somewhere and maybe get on. And so, you know, like the scope just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding.
So in terms of phishing and social engineering, I mentioned earlier how these bad guys now use ChatGPT to compose phishing emails that sound so legitimate. What can you recommend as something to pay attention to about how AI, the same AI, can be used to protect against phishing and social engineering?
So there are tool sets in play now that can determine likelihood that it was generated by an LLM, right? So if you have some sort of capability to run emails through that, I'm uncertain as to what vendors are supplying that right now, but I am aware that they have that capability, right? So if you have the ability to run it through that, then like you can say, oh, you know, there's a high likelihood that this email was generated by artificial intelligence. But then you have other questions, right? So like, you know, just like anything, you're going to have allow lists for domains and, you know, explicit email addresses and things like that, and how you manage those lists. And, you know, also what threshold do you set, right? Like what percentage of likelihood do you need to hit before you're like, okay, you know, this is definitely something that we don't want to have go directly to our users. Because like, you know, people say that the users are the weakest link, right? And then you have people on the other side that say like, you know, like people are your strongest asset. You know, it's training that's probably your weakest link at that point. And I think both of those are accurate, right? Ultimately, it's a lot easier to hack a person than it is to hack some technical piece of equipment for most organizations, because most people are at least guarding against the low-hanging fruit, right? Like, you know, you've got some basic firewall capability, a WAF or something like that in front of, you know, your external endpoints. You know, you're being careful about this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, are you educating your employees so that when, you know, somebody calls up Larry and says, hey, you know, I'm manager X, whatever, I'm in the other building, I need you to do this thing for me real quick. Like, you know, Is he going to be able to vet that, right? Like, what's the likelihood that you know, Larry's going to do something bad when he didn't mean to? Just because, like, ultimately, humans want to be helpful, right? Like, when I have requests for things come through my desk, right? Like, you know, prospective clients want to use me as a sounding board, like, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to say, no, I'm not going to spend my time to talk to you. And, you know, I want to be helpful. People will spend their time to try and help other people out, as long as they're not huge jerks. And so it's like really difficult to guard against social engineering campaigns without like a lot of training. And, you know, as far as like detecting, these things as an end user, it's really hard. You know, like it used to be that people could say like, oh, this email has like bad spelling, grammar, whatever, you know, it's almost like they're speaking in broken English or something like that. Or, you know, in other countries, if, you know, the syntax of the wording isn't a native speaker, you know, that registers something with you, right? Like if you're in Japan and you receive an email in like not quite right Japanese, you're going to start saying, well, I don't think that maybe this is right. And so anytime you get something like that, it's kind of a red flag. Well, now with AI and translation in AI, you can send these things out and they're going to sound a lot more credible. You're not going to have those other red flags, right? So like, then you have to look for other things, you know, like, am I verifying the sender of this email? You know, am I verifying the phone number that somebody called me on? You know, there's just a lot more due diligence that goes into all these things now than there used to be, just because they're finding ways to raise fewer and fewer red flags in people to the point where you have more people that are falling for stuff. Like, I just saw something, I think it was on CNN the other day, where it was like some sort of financial blogger or like somebody who gives advice on financial and money things. And she ended up handing $50,000 in cash.
I saw that.
In a shoe box, so right?
A you guy, saw that a one? Guy so driving like, a Mercedes, and then she went downstairs and handed the shoe box. It was so crazy.
Yeah, just like handing a shoe box of cash to somebody, and she got snookered, you know? And this is somebody who gives financial advice for a living. And it's probably because, you know, the things that the lengths that criminals are going to now, it's a lot easier for them to achieve them. Right. And, you know, it's making it really, really difficult on us as people that are just trying to do the right thing.
They knew her social security number. They knew she had a child and they knew where she lived. So a lot of things lined up perfectly because they did their homework and they were sounding believable enough that she was basically not thinking. They kept her on the phone for 5 hours. And even her husband got home from work and she was telling her husband that she got it. She's taking care of it. He shouldn't worry. So that was like the perfect storm. So someone didn't just call her up randomly saying, give us $50,000. No, they knew her. They knew who she was.
Yep.
And I think in the article I read, she admitted that she posts on social media, which helped those people with their background check on her. So a lot of training is definitely needed. Yep.
You know, with all of these companies that are aggregating data on all of us, and then the subsequent breaches of those companies, which puts all of our information out there for people to just stumble upon or purchase on the dark web. You know, it's easy to sound really credible, right? Like, you know, knowing her social security number, that could have come from any number of breaches, you know? And so when somebody calls me up and says, hey, Nick, I know that you brush your teeth at 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to be like, oh, wow.
Wow. So to touch on a lesser known aspect of this AI revolution, maybe you have an idea, maybe you don't, but I'm just going to ask anyway. What do you think about quantum computing and how this could impact cybersecurity as of right now?
It's hard to even think about, right? So the idea being that right now, the risk profile of individuals and companies is based upon level of effort, right? So, you know, let's take passwords as an example. So people have been saying you need a password of X length in order to be secure for a while now. And it used to be a much smaller number. And that's because of compute power, right? So like you used to be like, oh, you know, you need at least 8 characters in your password or something like that. And now everybody's like, you know, you use a password manager where you have like a passphrase to get into it. And it's like 56 characters long. And then, you know, your password manager is going to generate passwords for your bank that are 32 characters long or something like that. And you're not even going to know what it is. And, you know, when you do the math on it, it'll take 700 billion years to crack it at current compute power. Well, like, you know, now you have quantum computers, right, which are going to reduce all of those numbers yet again. So I think I saw on LinkedIn the other day where it's Google. Like, for your Gmail password, you could have up to 99 characters. That's their limit. And so at 99 characters, it's some ridiculous number of years that would need to be. So when quantum computers come out, you know, it's going to reduce that number. But at 99 characters, it's probably still going to be not worth somebody's time. It's easier to just call them up and try and get them to put 50 grand in a few bucks, right? Like, it's not worth it to try and crack at that point. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are living at smaller numbers, right? Like, their bank passwords are, you know, maybe 12 characters or something like that, because, you know, they try and be diligent, but like 12 characters isn't going to cut it anymore. I don't know what the limit actually is, but, you know, let's say it's a much higher number, like 20 characters or something is going to be your low bar for quantum computing. Like, well, now there's going to be a lot of people that are immediately, in a bad spot. And there's like password hashes that are just like out there and people are waiting, right? Like, you know, we have these password hashes that we've collected. We don't know what the actual password is, but we're going to be able to crack it by brute force once quantum computers come out. So we're just going to hang on to it and wait for, you know, the time when that happens. So quantum computing is going to have a big impact. Quite frankly, I don't know a whole ton about it because it's like it's too much to take in right now. Like, I'm not that vanguard IT guy that's on the edge of everything, because like I have to keep up with what's happening right now, and that's enough for me. last summer we had an intern that super smart, and she had been doing research with her school on quantum computing, right? So like, you know, during the school year, she's like actually working with a professor and like doing published research and stuff like that. And so over the summer, I asked her, I was like, you know, can you explain quantum computing to me like I'm a 5-year-old? And she tried, and I still didn't understand it. So you know, it basically came down to like something about switches, right? Like in our current age, it's like, you know, digitals, ones and zeros, right? And so like with quantum, it could be any number of states in between those two. And that's what allows things to be so much faster and yada, yada. But like, I still
don't get it. Yeah, you don't sound like you get it. I don't know. So I asked because it's something I've been paying attention to as the next phase of this AI revolution, whereby quantum AI models are going to be able to be deployed as needed in any field, whether it's medicine, to do some genetic computation. I don't know what they do in medicine. Whether it's in cybersecurity to protect against so many different networks using scarce resources, and on and on and on. So I'm actually presenting at this Secure World Conference in Atlanta in May. And that's basically what I'm going to be talking about, AI and quantum computing and threat intel and privacy and so on. So it's something I want to start getting ahead of. I mean, as much as I can, I'm not as smart as your intern, obviously. So maybe she's affiliated with some three-letter agencies around where you live. Who knows? So, in the interest of time, I want to be mindful of your time. As always, we've done 1 hour and it doesn't even feel like it. Is there anything you would want to touch on that we haven't covered so far?
Oh, man, we covered a lot of ground today, didn't we? I don't think that there's anything else that I really want to touch on. You know, really just try to express upon people that this phase that we're in right now is not going to go away anytime soon, right? Everybody's talking about like, oh, you know, AI is just a bubble or whatever, and, you know, we're all going to be back to normal in 6 months. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. You know, AI is here to stay, and it's going to impact our lives in increasing ways. And so, you know, just keep your eyes on it, you know, see if there's any ways that you can use it to your benefit. And then also try to stay aware of all of the ways that it could be used against you, and try and protect yourself.
Wow. You couldn't have summarized it any more perfectly. So basically, awareness, stay proactive, do not buy Wi-Fi enabled toothbrushes. Yep. I have a 4-year-old and is at that phase where he's getting into all these tech devices and gadgets. First of all, we have a strict time limit for him. He can only use any form of device on certain days, usually weekends, within certain hours. So that hopefully takes care of a lot of things. And of course, knowing me, putting a lot of restrictions on Apple Family Center and YouTube Kids and all these other apps. Of course, he doesn't download random stuff, so which is good. So thanks once again for coming on. This has been very insightful and fun and hilarious conversation. Of course, next time, hope you would join us and drop some knowledge for us again.
Yeah, anytime, man. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Bye.